I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic that you might have thought was past, but maybe contemporary events suggest it's not simply past. We're going to be talking about the Cold War. In particular, a prominent figure in the Cold War who shaped American attitudes and policy in the Cold War in very profound ways, but perhaps not a household name that all of us know of, but definitely someone we should know of. For our conversation today, I'm joined by James Graham Wilson. Dr. Wilson is supervisory historian for the United States Department of State. He is an author of a number of really fascinating books, studies of American history, American foreign policy, particularly in the late 20th century. Today, we're talking about his book and the fascinating figure of Paul Nitze. The book is America's Cold Warrior, Paul Nitze and National Security from Roosevelt to Reagan. James Graham Wilson, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Well, our listeners are pretty historically literate and informed, but and maybe have heard the name Paul Nitze, but he's not a household name for sure. Who was Paul Nitze?
Well, Paul Nitze was a practitioner of national security. He made it his profession to advance the interests of America and defend it, its core values, from external threats. He is probably best known as the author of a large study called NSC 68, which he a project he led in the early 1950s. But as I say in the book, open the book, he's somebody who was a boy when World War I broke out, and he was hiking with his family in Europe. And on the day, the horrible day of 9/11, he was preparing to meet then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and to talk about missile defense, because she was supposed to give a talk at a school, the School of Advanced International Studies in D.C. that was named after him. So his life spans both those moments, and his career certainly didn't end in 1950 when he wrote NSC 68. In fact, he stayed either in government or in D.C. and sort of playing a very influential role in shaping debates within the executive branch from that moment, from the spring of 1950 until early 1989.
So he was, as you note in the book, he held a number of significant positions in the United States, in the executive branch and American government administration. Before he, in 1950, joined the United States government, what was his career and how did that shape his early views?
Well, he had a very sort of interesting, exciting, and in some ways lucrative career on Wall Street in the 1930s. He worked for a guy named Clarence Dillon of Dillon Reed, an investment banking firm in New York. And he made a good deal of money, and he also invested in some sort of side projects. And he gained not only a mentor in Mr. Dillon, but in James Forrestal. And he followed James Forrestal to Washington I believe it was 1940, to kind of help then President Roosevelt prepare for the prospect that the United States might enter into World War II. And he saw that as a kind of patriotic duty, and he stayed there really for the rest of his life.
In the book, you talk about a particularly important moment in his work for the American government in the 1940s, which is he is sent to Japan after World War II to inspect the situation in Japan. Talk about what he was doing there and the effect that that had on him.
So he was, Nitze was involved midway through World War II. He was involved in something called the Strategic Bombing Survey first in Western Europe. And the issue at hand was that U.S. And British bombers were taking horrendous losses, and it was unclear whether they were actually harming the German economy. So it was a sort of applied history project done very quickly to try to determine, look at the large amounts of data and say, this is actually helping or harming the Nazi war economy. And then we can recalibrate and adjust the strategic bombing plans. That's all happening sort of during active hostilities with Nazi Germany. After the surrender of Imperial Japan, President Harry Truman sends Nitze and others to Japan to do a kind of similar study. And he also says, President Truman says to Nitze, while you're at it, try to figure out, why did they attack us in the first place in December of 1941? So Paul Nitze takes a very kind of expansive view of the second component of the strategic bombing survey. And he comes up with a number of kind of outcomes from it. And one that got him some attention and remains kind of, I think, something that generates attention was that he wrote in the preface, or at least strongly suggested, in the Pacific Theater strategic bombing survey, that it was not necessary to use the atomic bomb. And that's, created some controversy and remains a little bit controversial. I try to say in the book, and it's not necessarily original to me, that I think that Nitze had sort of come up with, in 1944, he had come up with his own plan for how to adjust a strategic bombing campaign to get the Imperial Japan to surrender, and he had been rebuffed. And so I think he was kind of motivated by a little bit by that, saying, well, if they'd only listened to me, the generals, we wouldn't have had to do it. But the second and more lasting lesson that Nitze draws from the experience of U.S. and Japan, Imperial Japan attacked the United States, according to Nitze, because the U.S. had let down its guard. It had, not built sufficient strength at the end of the 1930s to deter Imperial Japan from attacking it. And he's writing this in early 1946 when he's seeing similar dynamics play out with the Soviet Union in toward Western Europe, and in some sense toward Asia, but mostly in Western Europe. And he's sort of drawing parallels between that moment and the kind of years and months leading up to the U.S. entry into World War II.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that, because what's so interesting to me in the book is where Nitze fits in sort of the historical development of American thinking during the Cold War. Because not everybody, of course, as you note in the book, not everybody in the American foreign policy establishment assumes that there is going to be a Cold War with the Soviet Union. Some people harbor hopes that they'll be working together and the relationship forged in World War II will somehow continue, and that the Soviets will be good partners for the United States. What's Nitze's view after World War II and, in the late 1940s of the Soviet Union?
He was very skeptical of the spirit, the hope that there could be sustained reliance after World War II. But he was an outlier. I mean, I think in early 1946, most high-level U.S. officials hoped that there could be a continuation of the World War II spirit of cooperation. And there was certainly, on the part of the Truman administration, certainly a desire to demobilize and reduce the U.S. defense budget. I mean, just full stop. When Nitze, he's writing then Undersecretary Dean Acheson in early 1946, he's told, you're out of your mind. I mean, you're just looking for goblins. And then he's annoyed. P. Paul Nitz is annoyed that a few weeks after he's writing his own memos, George Kennan from Moscow writes his famous long telegram. And, you know, it's doubly annoying to Nitze because James Forrestal in D.C. is telling everybody you need to read George Kennan. And so, you know, Nitze feels a sense of rivalry over that. But I would say here is a moment for all of the students in the room to pay attention to how great a writer George Kennan was.
And then, of course, as the Truman administration continues and we get into the 1950s with the Eisenhower administration, where does Nitze position himself in Americans? Does he continue to be a hawk toward the Soviet Union? Does he advocate defense buildup? Does he advocate American engagement in the world, for example, in things like NATO? Or where is he in those discussions and debates?
He certainly advocates a defense buildup. And I mean, that's the main takeaway from NSC 68. Truman had appointed as Secretary of Defense named Louis Johnson, who had, I think it was a big D Democratic politician from the Midwest who had aspirations for higher office. And, you know, he promised Harry Truman that he would keep the defense budget capped. And, you know, from Truman's perspective, he wanted to what he called a fair deal. He wanted to kind of a domestic agenda, health insurance. The fall of 1949, we have to kind of think back a little bit here, right? So it was a truly terrible few months for U.S. foreign policy. You have the so-called collapse of the so-called loss of China, that is to say the triumph of the communist revolution, Mao's revolution. And you have irrefutable evidence that the Soviets have detonated an atomic bomb. Now, you know, keep in mind that the president of the United States had basically said publicly and privately, this is an event that will never happen. Well, it just happened. Okay. And so, and then meanwhile, you also have the really withdrawal, the British Empire, London saying it can no longer, you know, guarantee various parts of the world. So from Nitze's perspective, what you needed to do was, you know, both pursue the hydrogen bomb and or research into the hydrogen bomb and really ramp up defense spending. And that's what NSC 68, you know, the thrust of it is to make a clarion call for defending U.S., you know, common democratic values, small d democratic values, across the world on a global level. And this is, I think, in response to a question you asked earlier, you know, like, Kennan had originally said we should focus on four or five strategic points to, you know, push back against the Soviet penetration. And from Nitze's point of view, this was a global struggle, and we needed to wage it on a global scale. Originally, when Truman gets a copy of NSC 68 in, I believe, April of 1950, he doesn't want to listen to it because it's calling for triple. Well, he doesn't say the number, exact number, but it's clear that there has to be a massive increase in the defense budget. It's only when you have the outbreak of the Korean War in June of 1950 that Truman signs off on tripling the defense budget. And keep in mind, again, for students, you know, just putting yourself in the role of a policymaker at the time, or, you know, a Nitze, somebody at that level, that it felt very eerily to them in June 1950, with the North Koreans, you know, trying to unify all of Korea under communist banner. That felt very much like it had felt to their immediate kind of bosses in 1938, 39, 1940, that this seemed like the start of World War III.
Did he also at that time, as part of that increase and that call for buildup, did he advocate for the greater production and deployment of nuclear weapons?
There's a path of divergence here between Nitze and Eisenhower, is that when Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles come in 1953, they call for a so-called new look, which is to say we can keep conventional defense spending down so long as we spend a lot of money building relatively cheaper nuclear weapons, and then we'll say to the Soviet Unions, if you do X, Y, or Z, we will respond to the time and place of our choosing. And Nitze didn't like that. He thought that that's, you know, something that will lose credibility very quickly. His own view, and here keep in mind something that I think is very important throughout his career, is that he's not a politician, right? His view was always Americans can pay more in taxes. So under no circumstance should we, you know, cut taxes. If anything, we should be raising taxes to share the burden. And then we spend that to build the type of defenses that will deter our enemies. Eisenhower's is very important, I think, to keep in mind of Eisenhower's rationale, sort of whatever you think of the precise policies. But, you know, from Eisenhower's perspective, and this is all very kind of clearly laid out in the wonderfully illuminating minutes of Eisenhower's meetings. He said, well, if we have a large standing army in the same way that the Soviets had, that we will ultimately become a garrison state that, you know, will be accord with the American traditions that that we're used to. And, you know, they're really on kind of two different sides there, because I think Nitze's attitude was basically, you know, so what? It's not, he's, or I think you're overstating this. But, you know, from Nitze's point of view, he kind of gets, at the start, he's promised a job at the Pentagon, he goes to work there, and he's annoyed because John Foster Dulles then pulls it back because Dwight Eisenhower appoints Charles Bolin, a very talented Foreign Service officer, to be ambassador to the Soviet Union. And then a sort of conservative newspaper in Washington attacks him for this because he said that's a, you're appointing a Truman Democrat to do that. And then so John Foster Dulles pulls back Nitze's position as at the Pentagon. And so he's grousy about that. And he,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a combination of, you know, a real political or policy difference with, you know, having a personal grievance with the Eisenhower administration.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi. This is John Moser, Chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country, and they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So then, of course, he goes on to found the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins, right? SAIS,
yeah.
Called.
Yeah.
And then he goes back into government in the Kennedy administration, and in fact serves as Secretary of the Navy, if I'm not mistaken, from 1963 to 1967. So yeah. He's there. During the time of, you know, maybe the hot, one of the two, Korea and Vietnam, the hot wars of the Cold War, what kind of positions does he advocate when he's actually there in government, in the executive branch, connected to the military?
Well, if I could sort of step back a moment, because just say a word or two about Korea. And so he's director of policy planning during the ups and downs of the U.S. intervention in Korea and in 1950. And part of that involved his being very active in the planning for the potential use of atomic weapons in Korea, which is, I think, a kind of contingency that has sort of gotten forgotten and been forgotten in American in diplomatic history. But because of that, and because he had these sort of security clearances and had these experiences, or having been in the room for these conversations, it's one of the reasons why John Foster Dulles, even though they didn't really like each other, but Dulles would bring him in throughout the 1950s, almost as a sounding board or somebody to argue with, because there were very few people that he could draw on to do that. And so Nitze in the 1950s, even though he's running SICE, he has his sort of feet in different places. I mean, he's the CIA keeps him as a contractor. He's, you know, meeting with the Secretary of State. He's producing reports for Congress. And so he's always present, and he becomes a little bit more, I mean, involved in partisan politics. He certainly is expecting to come in at high office and in a big D Democratic administration. And then in 1961, he, you know, to his, I think, chagrin, turns down the role of national security advisor for JFK, thinking it wasn't important enough for him, which, you know, it became a kind of a big deal.
Not a great career move, right?
Yeah, not a great career move. Well, yeah, I don't think he would have gotten on with Kennedy that well, but certainly, yeah, it's his purposes for turning it down were mistaken. And so I think that, you know, during Vietnam itself, he's more there for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I think the Cuban Missile Crisis has a really searing impact on Nitze. And if I could just say another word or two, but before we get to Vietnam, that there's a very important, you know, point of divergence in Nitze's mind between him and the then Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara. And Nitze at that moment is the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. That would be the equivalent today in 2025 to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. So some of your listeners may know Bridge Colby is kind of in contention or has been nominated for that position. So that's sort of the job that Nitze had. October of 1962, Nitze's view here is that the Soviets ultimately back down in the Cuban Missile Crisis because they are aware of U.S. conventional and strategic, i.e. nuclear superiority, and they decide at the end of this affair, you know, we have to back down. The lesson then is you have to sustain U.S. preponderance. Robert McNamara's view is that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, both sides have gone to the brink of nuclear war. They've realized, you know, we need to step back from the abyss. And, you know, both sides are not going to make that mistake again. And so then in the kind of 2 or 3 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Nitze goes to the Navy, which has its own kind of, you know, whole sorts of buckets of issues that he loved to work. I mean, just he was excited about dealing with technological difficulties of subs or anything. This is his type of thing. But he's sort of out of he's not in the same role that he had been in the first years of the Kennedy administration in dealing with the planning for the escalation in Vietnam. And so there's nothing particularly, you know, noble about Nitze during Vietnam. And he goes there because as Secretary of the Navy, because there are naval forces there, but you know, his responses to McNamara are always, well, I really can't say we're winning, but you know, I can't say we should pull out either. When he becomes Deputy Secretary of Defense in 1967 and 1968, he, you know, refuses to testify in support of then President Lyndon Johnson's policies, and LBJ is quite furious with him. But you know, I think with Vietnam, I think that during the Vietnam era, Nitze would say the biggest problem from, and this is a very crass thing to say, you know, but I think Nitze would kind of say it, that the biggest problem was that we made the wrong, took the wrong lesson from the Cuban Missile Crisis. And meanwhile, as we got, you know, distracted in Vietnam, you know, the Soviets wound up building their nuclear arsenal to a level where by the end of the decade, you know, they had reached parity and were ahead in some instances.
So the 1970s come, of course.
Yeah.
What is, and that's a concern of a lot of people. For example, Ronald Reagan as a candidate yeah. in 1976 is talking about this. Foreign policy hawks are talking about this in the 1970s. We're falling behind the Soviets, especially, well, in conventional forces for sure, but including now in strategic nuclear forces. What's Nitze's view of that situation in the 70s, and what's he doing about the situation in the 1970s?
So in the 70s, even though he's closely identified with the Democratic Party, actually in part because of it, that Nixon and Kissinger think that Nitze would be somebody that could deliver Democratic votes in the Senate. So they bring him on to the first couple rounds of the strategic arms limitation talks with the Soviets, which began in 1969. Nitze had impressed them because he had helped lobby for a kind of funding for a ballistic missile defense system in 1969, the main purpose of which was to have something potentially to trade, to bargain with the Soviets. So he's the Department of Defense's representative to SALT. I think has a mixed experience. He feels that the treaty we get, or the interim agreement in 1972, he thought was not a very good deal, in part because Henry Kissinger had kind of intervened at the end just to kind of get an agreement before the 72 election. But he thought he had a good sense of the accompanying treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972. He was proud of his work on that. But his takeaway was that, you know, that was supposed to be accompanied by a much more ambitious agreement that would ultimately reduce nuclear delivery vehicles. His first takeaway was that if you have an interim agreement, then sort of the American people would be less inclined to spend money to build up strength to make sure we get a full agreement, because, you know, there would be a perception of, okay, well, we got this. I saw on the news, you know, the U.S. and Soviet leaders signing this treaty together. I understand, or sort of, I don't understand these numbers, but I know it's a good thing. All right, let's move on. And from Nitze's perspective, Wills is like, well, you need to keep funding the defense budget, and nobody wants to fund the defense budget after Vietnam. And that's something where I think it kind of, that's sort of important then, it's important now, and has been in between. But then the second thing that I think is very important is that Nitze becomes obsessed with something that is called the Nitze scenario. I mean, he didn't call it the Nitze scenario, but he spoke of this scenario so many times that admirers and detractors, particularly the latter, refer to it as the Nitze scenario. And it goes something like this, right? The Soviets have a very large missile called the SS-9 that they demonstrated in Red Square. They brought it out in the late 60s so everyone could see it. And this missile was so big that it didn't really fit the purpose. If you believe in mutual assured destruction, you shouldn't need such a large missile, because all you would need to do is to hold at risk the enemy cities, and the other enemy would be deterred because they can hold at risk your cities. So why did they build this? Well, the only rationale, you know, Nitze could see, and he wasn't alone here, was that it was something designed for the sole purpose of taking out the U.S. land-based Minuteman fleet. And okay, so why would they do that? Well, from Nitze's perspective, they would do it so that they would have the ability to say, okay, we've taken out your, you know, land-based forces. We have spared your cities. We are saying to the U.S. president in this ghastly scenario, if you retaliate, then we will attack your city. So you have to make the decision here to surrender and you know, save American lives. Alternatively, you could, you know, take out 100 million Soviet lives, but we would attack your cities. And from Nitze's perspective, no American would decline that bargain. And that's, I think, I mean, thinking about the American ideals, American traditions, that wasn't just sort of a guess. You know, that was a sort of, we elect somebody who is humane and, you know, the American people wouldn't elect somebody who would, you know, make the decision otherwise. All right. So that's the scenario. Now, what does it matter? I mean, right, there's a very low probability of that happening, hopefully never happening. But Nitz's point of that scenario was that the Soviets know it. They know that the Americans would back down. They know that they backed down in October of 1962 because it was a fundamentally different strategic landscape. And if they know that the Americans would ultimately back down, then they will be tempted to take risks everywhere else in the world, whether it's in Africa or Southeast Asia or in Latin America. They will feel emboldened, and the United States would, unless we dealt with this kind of decline in the strategic balance between U.S. and Soviet nuclear forces, unless we dealt with it in a dramatic way, we would always have to back down in crisis.
Well, so that leads in an interesting way in my mind to thinking about his role in a Republican administration in Ronald Reagan.
Because,
of course, by the time you get to the late 1970s, it looks like some of those fears have come true. For example, Soviet expansionism in the invasion of Afghanistan, Soviet aid to communist insurgencies in Africa and Latin America. This is the argument that you're starting to see out there. Like, we have not maintained that kind of deterrent posture, and containment has failed. And detente has failed, as Reagan argued, right? Containment is now failing. So Reagan argues, right, the third option, rollback. You know, as they said, Reagan, what's your strategy for the Cold War? We win, they lose, right?
Yeah.
Nitze joins the Reagan administration as and its motto of peace through strength, and a doctrine of rolling back the Soviet Union and winning the Cold War. Is he on board with the Reagan administration in that basic strategic posture? And how does he, what is he doing in the Reagan years?
Let me go back a year or two before 1981. In 1976, expected that he would be the Secretary of Defense in a potential Democratic administration. And so in 76, the candidate is Jimmy Carter. Carter invites Nitze to a meeting in Plains, Georgia, that followed a very long and probably unair-conditioned bus ride in which Nitze had managed to antagonize everyone else on the bus. And then they get to this meeting, and you can read the notes in our Foreign Relations volume, where it's very clear that, you know, everyone says to Carter, "I agree with you, sir. You know, what you said is great." And Nitze says, "I disagree with nearly everything everyone has said here." So it doesn't go well. You know,
it doesn't
go well, right? In 1977, Nitze gets involved with something on the called the Committee on the Present Danger, along with a number of kind of, you know, Truman Democrats, but then some other Democrats from the 60s, and, you know, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, for instance. And there is an attraction that, I meant to say this also, that in 1975, for reasons I've never understood, nobody can really figure out, Henry Kissinger declassified, then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger declassified Paul Nitze's NSC 68. Ronald Reagan becomes attracted to this. I mean, in his radio addresses during this period, after he comes very close to winning the nomination in 76, Reagan gives two or three broadcasts all about NSC 68. And I think from his perspective, and partly because he regarded himself as a sort of Truman Democrat who had seen the party, his own party move, and, you know, this more complicated than that, but he starts quoting Paul Nitze. And even though Nitze doesn't really, I think, formally endorse him, Nitze goes after the SALT II agreement that Carter had signed. And then Reagan in his radio speeches says, like quotes Paul Nitze, you know, author of NSC 68, saying that SALT II is a bad deal. So there's a kind of mutual confluence of interest in 1981, even though Nitze is saying, and it's very interesting in these wonderful firing line transcripts, which you can find, you know, Nitze is saying in 1981, I oppose the Reagan economic policy. I mean, just full stop. He says, I think we should be raising taxes. But, you know, so that all that notwithstanding, the administration, you know, they regard him as somebody who's knows the issues. And when Reagan, you know, announces the you know, we want to seek a INF negotiations or negotiations with the Soviets on the intermediate range nuclear forces in Europe, he appoints Paul Nitze to lead the U.S. delegation, which he does until the fall of 1983, when the U.S. Deploys forces, INF forces, and the Soviets walk out of the negotiations. So then from 1984 onward, Nitze is given the title, I may not be getting it totally right here, but it's basically special advisor to the president and the secretary of state for arms control matters. And so he's a very close advisor to George Shultz, but he's dual hatted as an advisor to President Reagan. And, you know, that's where I try to argue in the book that ultimately it's his greatest successes during this period of 85 and 84, where he sees in Ronald Reagan a sincere aspiration to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And what he does that I think is very important in all this is to come up with a strategic concept to integrate Reagan's aspirations to build the Strategic Defense Initiative with a kind of phased agreement to radically reduce nuclear arms over 3 5-year periods. And I kind of trace in the book the moment from December of 1984 where Nitze puts this forward to a very important, I think, letter from July of 1986, where Reagan puts this on the table to Gorbachev. And that sort of precedes the really important events that happened at Reykjavik later that year. So it's a little, you know, it's a little bit sort of, it may be a little bit obscure and really in the weeds.
But it's fascinating to me that you say that, James, because it's fascinating to me because it does seem like, and maybe this is too simple-minded on my part, but it seems like Nitze has moved in his thinking from maybe this goal is the same, but he's moved in his thinking about the means from strategic offense to strategic defense.
I think he entertains. Reagan definitely believes this 100%. And I think Nitze's not entirely confident that it's going to work, but he sees it as the kind of I'm tempted to say least bad option, but I'm not even sure that's correct. I think that he sees it as a way to get to the thing that he had aspired to since the late 1960s, which would be a reduction of so-called heavy nuclear forces, that is to say large land-based MIRV forces, that this is the way to get to that point. He wasn't as idealistic, I would say, as Reagan, in the sense that you could build this system and get it to work, but he was very intrigued and he thought it was worth pursuing. And, you know, he was in a kind of slightly awkward role because he had done so much to craft the 1972 ABM treaty. And then in 85 and 86, here he was trying to argue that a stipulation of it, the so-called Agreement D, would allow you to pursue a system based on other physical principles, you know, i.e. a laser, that was not actually in the treaty itself. I mean, he's contorting himself, but all for the purposes of, you know, he sees finally on the horizon the ability, you know, to get this large scale bargain.
Well, so he lives, if I'm not mistaken, he's born in 1907. He lives all the way until 2004. So he sees the fall of the Soviet Union. I think this is a quote from him, if I'm not mistaken, says, "One of the most dangerous forms of human error is forgetting what one is trying to achieve." That's a very interesting thought. Keep your mind focused on what you are trying to achieve at all times, particularly in a murky, muddled, difficult situation of the Cold War and arms control discussions and conversations. What in the Cold War, what was Nitze trying to achieve?
Whether it's Nietzsche or Kennan, they both were trying to achieve the same thing throughout the Cold War, which is to win without war. That is to say, to uphold American principles and values. And NSC-68 is a beautiful expression of kind of taking the ideas of the American founding and kind of thinking about them in moments of time, thinking about, you know, why did we have in the 20s and 30s, why did peace fail? And, you know, that's what NSC-68 is. And it's one of the reasons why I think after 9/11, Paul Wolfowitz and others, you know, quote from it, is that it's a beautiful expression of American values. And, but it's not, it's calling for a military buildup, but the purpose is not to use it, right? I mean, the purpose is that we will have a Cold War with the Soviet Union. There will be a resolution of it. And that resolution will be, you know, something short of another, short of World War III.
Well, I mean, it is a fascinating and amazing life from a man who, as you show in the book so eloquently, had such a profound effect in different moments, despite perhaps some being personally difficult at times, as you also point out in the book, despite having people like Kennan and Kissinger, big personalities and minds around him, he's had such a lasting effect through his own life and through Seyss on America's strategic thinking. And you bring that out so wonderfully in the book. Let me recommend to our listeners, our audience, again, the book by James Graham Wilson, America's Cold Warrior, Paul Nitze and National Security from Roosevelt to Reagan. James, thanks for being with us, and thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.